When you know this wisdom, together with discriminatory knowledge, you will be liberated from unhappiness. This is from the ninth chapter, from the very first verse of the ninth chapter. I will tell you, says Krishna to Arjuna, since you have put your trust in me, which means, you become a worthy disciple. Anushuyate means, you've become trustworthy. And so we learn from our teachers when we allow our teachers to teach us. Many of you in this room are teachers, and you should know this by now, that you can't teach anyone anything that doesn't allow you if they don't allow you to teach them. You see? So it's the student that's in charge. The student is in charge of whether or not there's any learning going to happen. And the student has to say at some level, look, I trust you enough to try to learn from you. And so, Krishna's telling Arjuna, all right, after nine chapters or so, you become a little trustworthy to be taught. So what am I going to teach you? I'm going to teach you guhya tama. Tama is a suffix in Sanskrit that means the highest, the most. And guhya means secret. So it's actually pretty interesting. In the 18th chapter also, the Bhagavad Gita presents its teachings as guhya, as secret teachings, as tantra, kind of. And obviously this isn't very secret. Bhagavad Gita is available in every bookstore pretty much in the world, and online from Amazon.com in translation in the language that you speak. So, what's secret about it? And it's not the words that are secret. It's the implications of the words that are secret. The implications are you are not who you think you are. And that has been kept as a secret from us all for a long, long time. We grab on to our individual personalities and we think that's all who we are. That's the entirety of who we are. So our true nature keeps itself a secret from us. It's there all the time. It's not like hiding in there somewhere. It's not, got some hiding place that it goes, and when we go look for it, it's not there. It's hiding. Like hide and seek. Your true nature is always there, brilliant, shining, apparent. But we don't look for it. We don't look for it because we don't think it's there. We have no trust. We have no trust that there's something higher. Our teachers tell us, there's a soul, there's your immortal soul, there's the self, there's your Buddha nature. You can hear this from all kinds of directions when it comes to, world religions. They're all talking, they're all pointing to something bigger than ourselves. That is in ourselves, not apart from ourselves, but that is in ourselves. But we refuse to hear. The teachings are always coming. It's how often do we tune in, How often do we listen? It's not for the absence of the teaching. Teaching's always going on. Your own true self is trying to teach you all the time. It's trying to say, look at me. This is who you are. And we go, where are you? Where is my true self? I can't find it anywhere. We're just blinded. We don't listen to our own highest teacher, to the guru within, who's always trying to reveal itself to us, and we ignore it. We ignore it in favor of the phenomenal. We ignore it in favor of the temporary, the transient, the impermanent. We ignore it in favor of our little selves, our egos. The attachment that we have to our egos is never to be underestimated, and it occludes the realization of who we truly are. So he's going to tell a great secret, high secret, okay? Because Arjuna has put his trust in the teacher. When you know this wisdom together with discriminatory knowledge. So again, this kind of phrase, dhyana, the sort of non-conceptual, immediate, recognition or realization, non-conceptual, and then together with discriminatory knowledge, together with the highest form of the intellect, the highest form of intelligence. The two forms of wisdom, right? non-conceptual wisdom and the wisdom of knowledge, of having the intellect cleared of the mental afflictions and ability to think straight. And when that happens, you will be liberated. Moksha, it's the verbal form of moksha. Moksha means liberation. You will be liberated from ashubha, from unhappiness. And, you know, again, if you wanted to try to sort of sum up things, all our unhappiness comes from not realizing who we really are. All of it. All of our unhappiness comes from clinging to the individual sense of self and not to our universal sense of self. All our unhappiness comes from a sense of isolation and separation from others and the world around us, which is an illusion. We have never been separate from the world around us. And we have never been different, fundamentally different from other beings. It's an illusion. But that illusion, clinging to that illusion of a separate self, of a separate individual self, causes only unhappiness. And we have some deep desire to overcome that unhappiness. This is why we take partners, this is why we have children, this is why we have friends, this is why we have pets, is to try to overcome that sense of separateness and to tap into something larger, something more general, universal, to tap into the network instead of feeling like an isolated node. You know what I mean? All right. You'll be liberated from unhappiness. This is the royal knowledge, Raja Vidya. This is the royal secret, Raja Guhya, the highest purifier, which is directly apprehended, virtuous, extremely easy to practice, we'll come back to that, and imperishable. So it's kind of interesting. What he's setting up, Krishna is setting up here is, you know, is what he's calling Raja Vidya. Vidya in Sanskrit, you know, can mean all kinds of things. You know, translated here, knowledge, but another way of thinking about it is science. There's all kinds of vidyas. There's the, you know, the vidya or science of astrology. There's the science of history. There's the science of, all kinds of things. And he's saying, like, of all the different things there are to know, all the different, you know, sort of ologies, psychology, anthropology, all the different kinds of ologies and sciences, this is the highest one. So he's kind of like saying, look, if you want to exercise your mind, your intellect, why not exercise it on the highest things? You know? It's probably good to learn a trade, for example, so that you can make a living, learn how plumbing works, or learn how to be a dancer, or learn, you know, these other kinds of things that, you know, that can cash out into, you know, into a paycheck. But how about applying the mind to how reality works? That's the king of the sciences. That's the king. And he also says, and it's a kingly secret. There's no secret bigger than this one. There's no secret bigger than the way things are and the way that they have kept themselves secret from us because we don't look at them, because we don't pay attention to them. We are much more enamored of our fantasies than we are of engaging with reality. This is the royal knowledge, the royal secret, the highest purifier. So we've already kind of talked about this. Wisdom is the highest purifier. Not karma by any means. You know, karma purifies, good karma, you know, purifies a little bit. But all karma involves us in impurity. All karma, because it's karma, it is defined by ignorance. It is defined as action impelled by ignorance. And that ignorance primarily is the idea that the individual ego is the actor. And that the actor will get what the actor wants. Impelled by intention. Impelled by purpose, impelled by will. Whether that will is good or bad, doesn't matter in a way. It matters, you know, sort of relatively, obviously. Better to produce good karma than bad karma. No question about that, okay? Better to produce good karma than bad karma. But all karma is the problem. So he's saying if with wisdom you purify yourself from the compulsion to act, and the compulsion that karma involves. And you are free, the great purifier, which is directly apprehended. The royal knowledge that is pratyaksha avagama. Pratyaksha, you know, this is a word for, there's three kind of ways to have valid perception. Maybe some of you studied the logic texts in Buddhism know. Pratyaksha is direct. So, you know, what you see if you know, looking at your hand, you have a direct perception of your hand. Visual perception. Then there's anumana. Anumana means inferential. You know, I put my hand like this in front of the screen here, in front of the camera, and then I go like this, do I still have a hand? You can't see my hand directly, right? But you can infer that, you know, the hand is behind my head right now, okay? Validly. And then agama means on the basis of authority. Here he's using the term pratyaksha not to talk about the six senses, not to talk about the physical senses, including the mental sense, including the sense of, of thought, rational thought, but in terms of direct perception. Yogic direct perception, sometimes they call it, which is non-conceptual, not using thought, bypassing the mediation of thought to directly realize what is true, what is real. So he says, this is what's directly apprehended, virtuous, and extremely easy to practice. Now, sukum, kartum. Kartum means to do. Susukum means very easy, very simple. So in what sense is wisdom easy to attain? In what sense is it simple? Okay, you ready? This is my best guess on why he's saying it's simple. It doesn't involve any effort. It doesn't involve any effort to achieve wisdom. It involves the stopping of effort. It involves the relinquishing of effort and relaxing, completely surrendering. So wisdom is not something that is attained or obtained or gained or created or, you know, collected. Wisdom arises, deeper wisdom I'm talking about, okay, the non-conceptual wisdom. Deeper wisdom arises when there is a cessation. And this is also, you know, this is also the teaching in Buddhism too. Nirvana and enlightenment are not created. They're not caused. They are not caused things. Nirvana arises when there is a cessation of those things that are blocking nirvana. And the same with Buddhahood. You see? So there's nothing to do. You see? Nothing to do to achieve nirvana or wisdom or enlightenment. Nothing to do. Only things to stop doing. Only cessations. Something stops. And one of the main things that stops in all of these cases is the desire for that. I want nirvana. I want wisdom. I want enlightenment, you see. That's the problem. The problem is that you want, you know, and the you that wants, you see, the individual self that wants to aggrandize itself. I want to be bigger. I want to be enlightened. I want to have nirvana, you see. I want to have wisdom. So it's easy. He says here, it's extremely easy to practice. Just relax already. Just quit wanting. Just quit striving. Just quit with the effort already, you know, and surrender. Completely surrender, which I think I mentioned yesterday, you know, kind of the bottom line of the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita in all three of its yogas. In the yoga of wisdom, in the yoga of action, and also in the yoga of devotion. They're all aspects of surrendering the individual will and surrendering the hold, the grasp that we have on the ego as if it were the only self there is. Arjuna, people who do not have faith in this truth do not attain me and return again and again, return again to the cyclic rut of repeated death. So here he's talking about shraddha. Ashraddha means you don't have faith. Shraddha means faith. What is faith? Faith means something like trust, confidence, having an inner conviction in the truth. The word is dharma. that's being taught here. Having some inner conviction that this is the case. And you know, it's hard for us to have that inner conviction. The ego's constantly drowning it out. But I suspect since most of you have stuck with it for the whole of these four classes now, that something in these teachings is reverberating, you know? Otherwise, you know, find something else to do with your Saturday night, Sunday night, you know? But if you may have come back because something about these teachings is, you know, is connecting somewhere in there. Yeah, you know, that seems right. That seems, I can't quite put my finger on why it seems right, maybe. I can't explain it, but it feels right, you see? And that's a little bit of shraddha. That's a little bit of faith, you know? It feels right. And then, of course, faith, confidence is strengthened by experience. And so I urge you to pay attention to your experience, you know? Pay attention to your own experience and see whether it's not the case that you have your happiest, most blissful moments in life when you lose yourself. When you get the individual ego out of the way and you integrate. You integrate with what's happening. You integrate with reality as it is. And you stop mediating it and talking about it in your mind and thinking about it and judging it and evaluating it and wishing it were different. It's in exactly those moments where we can lose ourselves, where we forget ourselves, self-forgetting, you know, you might call it, where we forget ourselves that we actually are happiest. And it's actually only then that we're really living. The rest of the time we're thinking about living. The rest of the time we're talking in our minds, you know, that inner voice in the mind, just talking. Talking about living someday instead of actually living, you see? So that's those experiences then strengthen our faith. It strengthens our faith that, yet, you know, yeah, if I could get my ego out of the way more, I'd be happier. And that's a weapon. Then the weapon gets sharpened a little bit because the ego will come back and say, nah, come on. I've been your best friend forever. You know, we've grown up together. Don't ditch me like this, you know. Come on, we're a team. And, you know, you just start taking the razor blade to the ego and say, no, you know, you're my problem, not my solution. You're my problem. And so pay attention to your experiences. Pay attention to when you are happiest. In the tantric texts, they have a very interesting kind of observation. They say there is a kind of insoluble connection. Indivisible, they call it. You can't separate them out. Between bliss and wisdom. Between true bliss, highest bliss, you know, your highest happiness and your highest understanding of how things really are. And that's a very profound observation, actually. You know, and I'm not talking about just kind of being a little bit happy with the Oreos or something that you have there for your, you know, snack. I'm talking about like, you know, totally getting blissed out. Like when you lose yourself totally in ecstasy. You know, obviously, you know, sexual orgasm comes to mind. You know, if you're sitting there in orgasm going, I am so happy here in orgasm, you're not having a good orgasm. You're not having an orgasm at all, actually, probably. You know, if you're self-conscious about it, you see, if the ego's still there talking. But it's when we can lose ourselves totally in the experience of bliss that we actually are then experiencing the highest wisdom. And you can put that in your pipe and smoke it for a while because that's a very, very interesting observation. Very interesting. The kind of wisdom that Krishna is talking about here is blissful. Has to be. Has to be blissful. There are no unhappy wise people. And there are no wise people who aren't happy. Is that the same thing, I guess? It's the same thing. Anyway, you see what I mean, right? There's no depressed wise people. Wisdom and true, deep, blissful happiness are the same thing. They're not like a wise person then gets bliss, you know. Bliss and wisdom Bliss and ultimate wisdom are two ways of talking about the same thing. In the ancient texts of the Hindu tradition, the Upanishads, they describe ultimate reality as Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means it's real, okay? It's not an illusion. So it's ultimate reality, Sat. Chit means pure consciousness. Consciousness that isn't conscious of something. Okay? When you are in this state that I'm trying to like point to, that we've all experienced, hopefully, in our lives, you aren't conscious of anything. You see? It's pure. It's not, there's the subject-object relationship breaks down. The subject is not conscious of an object. It's pure consciousness that arises without the dualism of the subject and object. Sat, Chit, and Ananda. Pure bliss. Pure bliss. So that's faith, okay? You get some faith through your experience. People who do not have faith don't attain me and return again and again to the samsara vartmani. Vartman is like means a path or a road. I've translated it here rut of cyclic existence. And then he says, and of repeated death. So we've talked about this before in these classes, actually. The deathless state is not attained by the individual. It's never going to be attained by the individual ego, by the person. So give it up already, you know? Stop fantasizing about what's impossible and start accepting reality as it is. You will die. Everyone in the room will die. I'm going to die. We're all personally going to die, okay? What's that Country Joe and the Fish song about going to Vietnam?
Whoopee,
we're all going to die, you know, like in the chorus. I don't know, you guys are too young to remember hippie songs like this. Anyway, that is truth. Some of us are too young. Some of you are too young. Anyway, but there is some part of us that will never die. And the deathless state can only be realized by radically readjusting the idea of who you really are. If you hold on, grasp to the idea that I am the individual, then of course you will die. And immortality is totally impossible. A total fantasy. But that is not all you are. In fact, that's not who you really are. And who you really are is deathless. Because it's birthless. Never been born, will never die. Everything that's born will die. Everything. Everything that has a beginning has an end. But that which does not have a beginning will never have an end. That which is immortal will never die, can never die. This whole universe is pervaded by my imperceptible form. Avyakta. Avyakta means you can't see it. Unmanifest. So the whole of the manifest universe, the whole of the universe of appearances is pervaded by something that's unmanifest. All beings reside in me, but I am not contained in them. These verses are very interesting. 9, 4, 5, and 6. Because I think Krishna here is trying, he's trying to talk about what can't be spoken of. So he kind of goes back and forth, as you'll see. So first of all, he says, all beings reside in me, but I'm not contained in them. The word is pretty much the same. Reside is stana, to stand in or to reside in. And then avastita comes from the same verbal root. Avastita means contained, but I'm not contained in them. So all beings reside in me, but I'm not confined to them. Something like that. I'm not completely described by them. I'm not contained by them. So I'm within all beings, but not confined by all beings. The infinite cannot be contained within the finite. The finite is a manifestation of the infinite, but the infinite can't be contained or confined. So he says, all beings reside in me, but I'm not contained in them. Then the next thing he says is, and yet beings do not really reside in me. So you see how he's kind of like flipping here. It's like, well, he just said that all beings resided in him. Now he's saying, but no, they don't really. Not cha matstani bhutani. They don't really reside in me. So, I think he's struggling here. I think he's struggling with how to try to talk about what you can't really talk about. So, self, God, Krishna, Buddhahood, ultimate reality is what they call in Sanskrit nirguna. Nirguna has no qualities. without qualities. So beings have qualities, saguna. We all have qualities, you know. Everything in manifest reality, everything in the world of appearances has qualities. That's what makes them appear, after all. Okay? Something that didn't have qualities, I mean, minimally. Something that didn't have a right side, a left side, a front side, a back side, a top side, a bottom side, would be imperceptible, right? You couldn't see it. It's impossible, because it'd be everything. You know, you could say everything or nothing, depending on what you wanted to say. And that's God, see. That's Krishna. That's who you really are. Those things that do have left sides, right sides, front sides, back sides, top sides, bottom sides, are not Krishna, are not God, okay? So he's both, all beings reside in him, but then he said, well, they don't really reside in me. They can't really reside, the finite can't really reside in the infinite. The infinite is the condition of possibility for the finite. But it can't be, it doesn't subsume the infinite. The finite can't subsume the infinite. Check out my superhuman yoga. Pashya, pashya means, hey, look, you know, check it out. Look at, and then yogam aishvara. Aishvara means, you know, godly, divine yoga. This is, maybe it could be a new brand of yoga. You know, now that we've like run out of different kinds of yogas, all these different kinds of yogas, maybe have divine yoga. You just like start having divine yoga there at Masuka Center, okay? Yeah. Maybe Chris and Danielle could like start teaching that. Check out my superhuman yoga. I am what brings living beings into existence and what sustains them. I am their birthplace, I am their cause, and I am their support. But myself does not reside in them, not subsumed by them. This is very tricky. Theologically, it's very, very tricky what he's trying to say here. And I'm not, to tell the truth, not quite sure that I fully get it. So I'm doing my best, okay? The self does not, the true self, okay? Ultimate reality, God, is not dependent on God's manifestations, on the manifestation of reality, not dependent on it. So the deity exists independently. They could say the self, the true self, expresses itself but is not connected to or attached to its expressions. It expresses itself in the world of form, in the world of manifestation. But it's not attached to its expressions. It's free from its expressions, you see? Not dependent on it. One of the commentaries on this verse by Swami Shivananda, he's in the Satyananda kind of lineage. He says on the commentary on this verse, he says, this is a great mystery. This is a really great mystery. This is hard to get our heads around. He says, it's like empty space. You know, this simile is used quite a bit when you're trying to talk about like things that can't be talked about. It's like empty space. Empty space doesn't have a connection to what's put into it. The bottle is in empty space here, right? It resides in empty space. But empty space is not connected to it. It's still there when the bottle goes. The space that this bottle is in is still there when there's no bottle in it, right? It's not affected by it. It's not attached to it. It's not connected to it. Independent of it, you could say. Think of it like this, he says, just as the mighty wind goes everywhere while always residing in empty space, so too do all living beings reside in me. So, again, resorting to simile, just as energy, the wind, you know, pervades empty space, but isn't quite empty space, you see, The wind exists in empty space, but isn't empty space. So too does Krishna exist in what is in reality, but isn't subsumed by the reality. You know, Krishna is the empty space, as well as the wind that moves through the empty space. But the wind that moves to the empty space, the world of appearances and so forth, is not subsumed by the empty space that it pervades. You see what I mean? I'm trying my best here, okay? What he's trying to talk about, for those of you who've been studying Buddhist philosophy, is the relationship between deceptive and ultimate reality. He's trying to discuss deceptive reality is the reality of appearances, and ultimate reality is the reality that is unmanifest, actually, but makes manifest reality possible. The emptiness of things makes the things possible the way they are. If things weren't empty, for example, they could not exist the way they are. How do they exist? Impermanent, constantly changing, without a self, and so forth. They are empty. Empty of the permanence, empty of essence, you see, empty. If they weren't empty, they would not be what they are. They would be permanent, they would have some kind of enduring, unchanging essence. So the emptiness makes the deceptive reality possible. So there's a kind of relationship between the two, but they're not identical. It's a very tricky, trying to talk about the relationship between the finite and the infinite, between deceptive reality and ultimate reality, between the finite and the infinite, between that which has qualities, that which can be described with qualities, and that which has no qualities, nirguna, that which is changing versus that which is changeless, and the relationship between these things. All right, next verse. At the end of an eon, all beings are withdrawn into my nature, Arjuna. And then at the beginning of a new eon, I project them out again. Some of you know that there is a teaching in the yoga texts as well as the tantric texts, what's called laya, L-A-Y-A. And here he's talking about laya. He's talking about projecting out everything and then withdrawing everything in, until it becomes nothing again. And then expanding it all out like that, like breathing. You know, you breathe out, and then you can breathe it all back in. Breathe out, is cosmically, the cosmic breath of life, you know. Things come out, that means they're expressed. That means they take form. And then they come all back in. You know, it's like the tides of the ocean also. Tide goes in and out, in and out, in and out all the time. And Krishna's saying, like, this is descriptive of reality. This is the play of reality. The play of reality between the expression of appearances, the expression of form, the expression of objects in the world, events in the world, and then the withdrawal of them all. There are really amazing meditations that some of you know, and maybe the ones that don't know can ask the ones who do know for some version of a laya meditation. It's taught in the yoga texts kind of fairly openly. In the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, it's mentioned quite a bit, actually. Laya, and what a laya meditation would look like. Brandon was asking about the kind of meditational sort of techniques that would relate to kind of what we're talking about in these classes. And that's certainly one of them. That's a meditation technique of just withdrawing all of the projection, withdrawing all of the illusion. See, and it's not Krishna out there that's, you know, projecting and then withdrawing. Krishna is you. Krishna is your true nature. Krishna is your Atman. And you project. Then you project. From the Atman comes all of this kind of diversity of nature and also the sense of individual self. And then, you know, little by little, you can learn techniques where you take it all back in. And you reduce it to where it came from, to the nothingness, you could say, to the absence of form, to the absence of expression, just like exhaling and inhaling it all back in. At will, I repeatedly project this entire collection of beings who, powerless themselves, depend on my own nature. So here, you know, kind of like, pretty much full on saying, like, you know, we as individuals, as expressions, individual expressions of our deeper nature, of Krishna nature, Krishna consciousness, if you will, we have a certain kind of, there's a certain kind of powerlessness to us. And, you know, I've been trying to emphasize this at various junctures in this teaching. It's really good to get in touch with that powerlessness, and to lose the sense that the ego is in charge of everything. That the ego is in charge of your life, that the ego is in charge of other people and can make them, you know, kind of conform to your will, and that the ego is in charge of events as they unfold. The ego will be constantly disappointed to realize as life unfolds that it is not in charge. It has never been in charge. Impossible. And secondly, as I mentioned before, but you know, in terms of the wave machine, we don't want to be in charge. It really doesn't want that. It doesn't want everything to be predicted. It thinks it wants that, you see? The ego thinks that it wants to be in charge. But if the ego really were in charge, the ego would be very disappointed with that. So no worries about it. Just relax about it already. You know, embrace your powerlessness. Embrace the fact that you're not in charge here. And that goes a long ways to, you know, getting some good, healthy humility when it comes to, you know, your place in the universe. You as an individual say your name to yourself in the universe. So Krishna says quite clearly here, I repeatedly project this entire collection of beings who powerless themselves depend on my own nature. And these actions do not bind me. So now this is one of the many verses, several verses that we'll have today that kind of point to the next topic of these classes, karma yoga. So Krishna's saying here, look, I'm doing all kinds of, I'm doing everything actually. I'm projecting the whole universe. And then I withdraw it, I project it again, I withdraw it, I project it again. You know, it's talking over the course of eons. And these actions of mind do not bind me. I am not bound in the karma of this karma. See? Action, the word for action here is karma. But I'm not bound by this karma, by these actions. I remain set apart, unattached to these actions. So here he's talking about karma yoga, about how to act without acting. Actionless action. How to act without creating the karma that keeps us bound by karma. And the secret here is to have no intention, to have no will, to have no desire. God doesn't desire anything. You know, the idea that God would desire something would be a pretty crappy God, a God who feels incomplete somehow. You know, you could trade that one in on a much better model. God doesn't create the universe because God's lonely or God, you know, needs something that God doesn't have already. You know, and don't forget who God is. That's your true self. So then why? You know, maybe Alicia's already thinking, well then why? Why do things come into being? Why is there a universe? And it's like, you know, why did God create everything? And the answer that the texts give, you know, kind of consistently is lila, play. Just playing. Just effing around, you know that expression, you know what I mean? Just playing around. Just playing around. No purpose, you see? That's what play is purposeless action. Action for its own sake. Not to get something or to achieve something or attain something. Not action done with a sense of longing, with a sense of wanting to accomplish something. You know, no purpose. No intention. These actions do not bind me, Arjuna, because I'm not doing them for any reason. I'm not doing them for any purpose. So that's one sense of you know, what it means to, what it would mean to act like Krishna does, is to act spontaneously, to act without planning, forethought, without motivation, without intention, without any purpose. And that's karma yoga, and we'll talk more about it like for four classes in the next course. And you guys will all have access to that audio, even though I'm going to be doing it with the Cape Ann group by video. You know, the audio will be available, and if you're interested in like getting the full works when it comes to the Bhagavad Gita, probably important to listen to all three courses. I remain set apart, unattached, you see, unattached to the action, unattached to the idea that there is an agent of action. And that's another aspect of karma yoga. There's no real actor. No real agent here. It's just play. It's just activity for its own sake without it being for some purpose or for somebody's purpose, for some individual's purpose. Nature brings forth both animate beings and inanimate things through my direction, and because of this, Arjuna, the world goes round and round. Stupid people, not knowing of my higher existence as the great Lord of all beings, seeing only the human body I have assumed, to treat me contemptuously. So, which human body has Krishna assumed? And it's a little bit of a trick question, okay? Every human body has been assumed by Krishna. Every one of us. So the implication here is treating anybody contemptuously or poorly is to have contempt for God. Because we are all God. We are all incarnate by God. We are all the so many different bodies that God has assumed, that the true self has assumed. So, there's a tendency in some kinds of religious practices to get like all devout about, maybe a statue of God or a statue of the Buddha, or to get, really, really devoted to a guru or to the Dalai Lama or something like that, at the expense of where all the other gurus are, at the expense of the divine as it appears in each and every one of us. And so that's the teaching here about Krishna. Krishna is not separate from any of us. So anytime that we treat another human being, disrespectfully, contemptuously, every time we try to hurt somebody, who are we really hurting? You see, who are we really hurting? We're not seeing God in them. We're not seeing the God in them, which is the same God that's in ourselves. So you can say if we're contemptuous towards other people who embody God, we are also being contemptuous to ourselves. Because we also are just like them. We also are embodying God. So, that phrase that Krishna used, whether the Krishna that they see is in themselves or in others. There was a verse like this. Krishna is in all of us. And we should, in the highest kind of self-esteem is to esteem ourselves as God. And the highest form of respect for others is to see that all other beings are equally God too. And so he said, don't be contemptuous of me, regardless of how I appear, in whatever kind of body I appear, I'm still the same God. Their hopes are in vain. Their actions are futile. Their hopes are in vain. He's talking here about deluded people. Muda. Muda means ignorant people. I was reminded here, their hopes are in vain. I was reminded of a passage in the New Testament where Jesus tells his disciples probably, don't lay up your hopes in transient things. Don't put all your hopes in things that are subject to, I forget exactly the term, rust and moths or something. Moths will eat your clothes and your car will rust out. Don't put your hopes in transient things. Put your hopes in something that doesn't change. Something that is not subject to impermanence. So their hopes are vain because they put all their hopes into transient things. And transient things change. So they'll be disappointed. And he's not talking about he's talking about us, all of us. We all kind of put our hopes in the internet working for the webcast. And then, sometimes the internet says, well, the hell with you. I'm not going to work because it's a transient thing. comes and goes. it's the same with everything. Put your hopes in your new iPod, put your hopes in your new car, put your hopes in your, groovy house or, condo or whatever. And these are all transient things. Put your hopes in your body. Transient thing. So their hopes are in vain. Their actions are futile because they're bound up in expectation. The actions of ignorant people like ourselves are always bound up in expectation. There's a phrase that's kind of worth remembering. Expectations are disappointments in training. Expectations are disappointments in training. to the extent that we have expectations of ourselves, of our lives, of other people, we will be disappointed. They are just disappointments waiting to happen. So how to live without expectations? Very interesting idea. This is, you know, kind of like, again, bleeding over into the next course. How can we live means act in the world. And Krishna is not telling us not to act. Just the opposite. You know, engage in the world, act in the world, but expectationless, purposeless, intentionless. Okay? And that's a very difficult thing to try to do. It's hard to be free. And that's exactly what freedom would look like. Not having to act. Not having to try to attain something that we don't have already. Not being impelled to act, but being free, acting freely, spontaneously, happily. And again, for those of you who have studied the Uttara Tantra, there's at least one of you or two of you that studied it with me, or intensively, or two of you, three, I don't know, something like that. Anyway, you might recall that this is exactly how the activity of the Buddha is described, as without intention, spontaneous, uncontrived, without thinking or forethought, without like sitting around going, I need to save the cat who's gotten up on the tree on Alpha Centauri and then, you know, swoop down with the Buddha powers and save the cat. Not like that, okay? Always active, but without intention. Always involved in the world, always trying to help in the world, but without any purpose, without any intention, without any forethought, without any planning, just spontaneous action. And that's just another way of talking about the same condition of freedom, of liberation. But the great souls, Arjuna, taking refuge in my divine nature, are devoted to me. Here's sort of wisdom fading into bhakti, fading into devotion. They're devoted to me. With their minds on nothing else, they understand me as the imperishable source of all beings. Let's do the next one too, because they kind of go together. Always glorifying me. The verb is kirta, kirtayanta, kirti, like kirtan. So they're glorifying me in the sense of they're singing my praises. Always glorifying me and striving to firmly keep their vows, prostrating with bhakti, with faith. I've translated it here. Those with unwavering discipline, nitya yukta, those whose yoga doesn't waver, they worship me. Here he's talking about what you might call deity yoga. Deity yoga, of yoking yourself to the deity, who is no other than your true self. And there are methods for, you know, for this too. And, you know, I leave it up to the teachers there at Mahasukha to transmit some of those methods to students. But the basic method is, and I, you know, put the cat right out of the bag, the basic method is to just, well, how would a God act? If I were God, and I am God, actually, you know, ultimately, how would I act, you know? What would I do? What would I think? And what they call in Christianity, imitatio Dei. Imitatio Dei. Imitate the God. There's also imitatio Christi. Imitate Christ. Live like Christ would. Or live like God would. And these verses are kind of like pointing in that direction. You know, just live like Krishna. Live like your best understanding of how a deity would live on this earth in this life. And, you know, one thing for sure, okay, deities wouldn't have mental afflictions. A deity with a mental affliction is, you know, low class. It's very low class as a deity to have a mental affliction. So, you know, be a classy god, And no mental affliction, no unhappiness, no dissatisfaction, no discontentment, no striving, no effort, just playing around, helping other people, playing around, you know, doing what there is to do, you know, without without expectation, without, you know, striving, without effort, and like that. And so that's one method he's talking about here. Others, and he says, others offering the wisdom sacrifice, jnana yajna, worship me as the omniscient one, alternating between manifesting as the one and the many. So here he's talking about another kind of like relationship to God, and that's one in which you sacrifice the individual self for the true self. That's what the wisdom sacrifice means. Sacrificing the individual ego for your true nature, your true self, and then seeing it everywhere. Worshipping me as the omniscient one, alternating between manifesting as the one and the many. Alternating between the world of appearances and the world of emptiness, of ultimate reality. Both are them. Both is Krishna. And so you try to see the true self in all things, in all beings, whether they are manifest or unmanifest. The two aspects of the one. Manifest aspect, that's the many, and the unity, the oneness of unmanifest reality. You know, I was thinking, I'll probably come back to this in the third course on the Bhagavad Gita on devotion. But there's three kinds of understanding. I think there's three levels of devotion. So I just share this with you and then we move on. There's one kind of devotion to God as if God were external to you. And this is the kind of devotion I think a lot of people are familiar with. You know, you worship the deity as if the deity were external, were outside, was outside of yourself. Then there's a deeper, I think, understanding of bhakti, of devotion. And that's to worship the deity within you. To worship the deity who is you, internally, you see. But the highest form of devotion is to worship the deity who is both outside of you and inside of you. And then you are worshiping the one in all the many forms that the one takes. Okay? So those three levels of devotion. And, usually people stick at the first one, I think. Usually if people have any devotion, have any kind of like spiritual sensibility when it comes to God, when it comes to theism, they stick to the first level. It's rarer to get to the second level of trying to see the deity as you. And there are people in the room who have been initiated into practice where that is your practice, to see the deity within. But then the third level is the culmination of that whole practice, and that is to see that there is nothing that is not the deity. There is no visual form. There's no form that isn't the deity's form, that isn't the body of the deity. There's no sound that isn't the deity's mantra, that isn't the deity speaking. And there's no thought that goes through your head that isn't the deity thinking through you. And that's a pretty esoteric teaching, but you just got it, okay? That's trying to see the deity both outside and inside. What's going through your mind is the deity. Is Krishna talking to you? Krishna whispering, you know? Like a Krishna whisperer. Like a horse whisperer or something like that? A Krishna whisperer. Whispering in your mind. And then everything that you see and hear, as well as, you know, touch and smell and all like that. Just so many forms of Krishna everywhere. Krishna consciousness, that's what Krishna consciousness means. All right, let's do the last section. Finish it off here. Fixing the mind on the imperishable. Those who worship me with their minds absorbed in me, fixed on me, you could say, who are always disciplined, nitya yukta, always doing their yoga, and endowed with the highest faith, with shraddha paraya, the highest form of faith, I regard as the most disciplined. Yuktatama, the most yogified. Those who worship the imperishable, akshara, that which does not die. The indefinable, anirdesha means you can't say, you can't teach it. You can't teach anything about it, literally. You can't say anything about it. The indefinable, the unmanifest, avyakta, the omnipresent, sarvataga, the thing that goes everywhere, literally. Omnipresent, achintya, the thing that cannot be thought. Those who worship that which cannot be conceived of, literally. The immutable. Kutastha is an interesting word in Sanskrit. It means literally standing on a mountaintop. You are fixed. You are not changing. You are not... So he's talking here about, you know, the deity, the one, the true reality as totally unchangeable, immutable. The immovable, achala. Achala means doesn't do anything, doesn't fluctuate in any way. The unchanging, dhruva. Dhruva means fixed. Dhruva is another word for the pole star, actually. It's fixed, it doesn't move, doesn't change. Subduing all their senses, impartial, even-minded, samabuddhi. Rejoicing in the welfare of all beings, selfless. They also reach me. The difficulty, he says, klesha is the word used here. It doesn't always mean mental affliction. It can also mean something that just causes problems. So he's saying it's going to be difficult. The difficulty is even greater for those whose minds are fixed on the unmanifest. Trying to put your mind on what your mind can't think is a difficult procedure. So, Brandon, this is kind of getting a little bit at your question yesterday on, well, how do I meditate? How do I meditate on that? And he says, well, it's not going to be easy. It'd be a whole lot easier to just like meditate on a picture of the Buddha, okay? Meditate on a picture of your guru, you know, meditate on something, saguna, something that has qualities. But to meditate on something that has no qualities, that you can't, literally cannot wrap your mind around. He says, well, that's difficult, very difficult. For the way of the unmanifest is hard for an embodied being to attain. And it's interesting he uses that kind of language. Dehavat. Dehavat means somebody who has a body. Deha means a body. So it's hard to detach from the manifest as an embodied being. To the extent, especially to the extent that we are attached to our own bodies and to the limitations of our own bodies. You see, our bodies don't reach everywhere, right? They are bounded. They are finite. And to the extent that we are attached to our bodies, we are attached to a finite sense of self. We are attached to a finite kind of a being. So it's hard for us attached to finitude. If there's infinitude, there's finitude, I guess. So attached to finitude to try to contemplate the infinite. So he's saying, not easy here. Okay? Not easy. But those who are thoroughly devoted to me, give up all their actions to me, and worship me, meditating on me with single-minded yoga. Single-minded, un-anya, means not on anything else. So keeping your mind, your yoga, un-anya, without thinking about anything else, think about God, and then give up your actions to me. See, I'm ending this course, you know, kind of pointing us to the next course. This is a full-on about karma yoga. And he's indicating that it's going to be easier. Rather than trying to, you know, kind of attain that unmediated direct awareness of ultimate reality that is unthinkable, that cannot be conceived. You know, it's easier to just give up your actions, to surrender the self in terms of letting Krishna live your life. Surrender your actions to Krishna. And so, as we will see, I think, as these courses unfold, we started out at the hardest level. Jnana yoga, the yoga of wisdom, is presented as the most difficult. And so then he says, so, you know, if you want to be lazy about it, you know, go for a easier one. Karma yoga is easier than jnana yoga. Karma yoga is easier than the yoga of wisdom. And easiest of all is the yoga of devotion. And they all lead to the same goal. So, you know, it's a little bit of a shell game. It's a little bit of a trick. Well, why wouldn't you pick the easiest one? If the easiest one leads to the highest goal, just like the hardest one, why bang your head against a rock wall, you know? Just do the easy thing. But I think, you know, he was writing for people 2,000 years ago. He was writing, it looks like, you know, for educated people, but nevertheless people who weren't as educated as we and who weren't as reliant on their intellect as we are. So in a way you could say, you know, just as something to throw out there, you see if it's true or not for you. But it seems to me that the way of knowledge, of wisdom and knowledge, is going to be easier for us than the way of action or devotion. Because we're more inclined to it, actually. We're more inclined to using our heads, to thinking, to, you know, to try to, you know, rationalize, to try to intellectualize and all like that. And so it depends who you're talking to as to which mode is easiest, okay? But they all lead to the same goal. So in this verse, in 12:6, he's saying, you know, just do everything for me. Do everything in my service. Give up all actions to God. And that'll be easier. For those whose minds are engrossed in me, I soon arise as the Savior from the ocean of death. So no matter how you do it, if you're thinking about God all the time, if you're thinking about ultimate reality, if you're thinking about who your real self is and are devoted and surrendered to it, then the Savior will come. You see, that is your Savior. The devotion itself, the surrender itself is your Savior. Focus the mind on me. Fix the intellect on me. There is no doubt that you will dwell only in me from then on. Think about God all the time. So this is a kind of a verse 12:8 here on mindfulness. You see, you know, one way that that we're taught mindfulness, it's an ancient tradition, it's an ancient technique of and method for teaching mindfulness, is to be mindful of yourself. You know, to be mindful of, you know, what you're thinking, what you're doing, what your mindset is, what your emotional framework is, which is all fine and good. Good to be mindful like that. But to be mindful of your true self, that's a higher form of mindfulness, you see. Instead of just kind of, the danger of the mindfulness as it's usually taught is that you get self-obsessed. You know, what about me? What am I thinking? What am I feeling? You know, what's my mindset now? What are my emotional framework? What's my emotional temperature? Constantly thinking about you. And I don't mean the higher you. I mean the individual you. So it can, you know, it's an important way to start, I think. An important way to start paying attention to living instead of like spacing out about living. But it can also be a little bit neurotic. You know, it can lead to a certain kind of neurosis and sort of self-obsession, you know. So he's talking about a kind of mindfulness here, but he's talking about being mindful of your higher self, which has nothing to do with, you know, what particular emotion is, you know, kind of going through your heart and mind at that particular moment. It's to fix on the unchanging, the eternal, the beginningless and endless. And if you are not able to fix the mind unwaveringly on me, then seek to reach me through the practice of yoga. Abhyasa yoga. Abhyasa means practice. Yoga. Here it seems to be, you know, these are a little bit difficult to decipher, but it seems to be pointing to a meditation practice, a formal meditation practice. So in 12:8 there, you know, he's talking about being mindful as you go through your day. And maybe in 12:9 he's talking about, you know, sit down and practice, abhyasa, practice fixing your mind on me in a meditational setting, okay? Which may be a little bit easier, he's saying. It may be a little bit easier than trying to keep that kind of mindfulness on God all day long. So you know, just have a little practice. You know, sit down for 15 minutes and meditate on me. If you are incapable even of practice, be intent on action dedicated to me. Dedicate your life to the service of God. Doing actions only for my sake, you will achieve perfection. And then he says, but if you are incapable of doing even this, then take refuge in my yoga and act with self-restraint, having abandoned all fruits of action. So he's setting up some kind of hierarchy here. And it's, you know, like I said, it's not entirely clear to me how the hierarchy goes. I'll give you my best shot at it. But in this verse, 12:11, he's saying, you know, this is the easiest of the methods I've just talked about. It's very hard to keep your mind on me all the time. It's very hard to even like meditate on me once in a while. It's hard to act in a devoted way. It's hard to surrender your actions to God. But it's even harder in a way. It's even easier, the easiest, if you're incapable even of doing this, then take refuge in my yoga. It means take refuge in the way that Krishna acts. Take refuge in the yoga of Krishna, which means acting without attachments to the fruits of action. Take refuge in my yoga and act with self-restraint. Yata Atman means like restraining your egotistical inclinations and abandon all fruits of action. Sarva karma pala tyaga. Sarva means all. Karma means action. Pala means the fruits of action. What you expect to get out of the deal. Tyaga, give it away. Let go of it. So here he's saying that the easiest of these four methods is to practice karma yoga. Practice the yoga of action without attention to the fruits of action. And that's a whole course on that coming up. But you know, maybe just in as much as I've like talked about it a little bit, you know, you can maybe get a sense that although it sounds easy, it's not gonna be easy. That's not going to be easy either, okay? Krishna's trying to do a sales job on Arjuna a little bit, you know, try this, it's so easy, you know, money back guarantee and all that. But, you know, it's not easy. Not easy to give up expectation. Not easy to give up, you know, intention in action of what I want from this action. Not easy. Not easy at all. Wisdom is superior to practice. And meditation is better than wisdom. But better than meditation is the renunciation of the fruits of action. For true peace, shanti, comes immediately from that. So here's how I think it goes in terms of like the hierarchy that's being set up in these verses in the 12th chapter. You know, at the sort of lowest level is abhyasa, actually, practice. Practice means your practice, practice of yoga, of ethics, of regular meditation, of study. You know, this is kind of entry level. You know, it's obviously important to do, but it's kind of for beginners. Then higher than practice, it says, wisdom is superior to practice in 12:12. Higher than practice is wisdom. And, you know, again, in the two senses that we've been talking about wisdom all through the course, in wisdom in the sense of cleaning up the intellect, buddhi yoga, cleaning up the intellect, purifying the intellect, understanding clearly with your rational intellectual mind what's what. And then that leading into direct perceptions, direct experiences of reality as it is, unmediated by concept. But then he says, dhyana, meditation is better than wisdom. So this is like, what does that mean? In the yoga texts, dhyana means holding your mind fixedly on the object of meditation. So the last three angas, the last three limbs of yoga are dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Dharana means you put your mind on it. And it doesn't say how long. Just put your mind on it. Just put your mind one pointedly on something. So, in relation to this, you know, to this hierarchy here, wisdom means that you've put your mind on something true, on something real. But then he says, and meditation is better than wisdom. So, dhyana means that you fix your mind on it, you hold your mind on it. You hold your mind on it unwaveringly. So, not just like occasional glimpses. You know, occasional glimpses into reality, into the truth. But keeping your mind on it in a kind of a continuous way, holding your mind on the self, on the true self, in a continuous way. And then, very interesting, at least in this presentation, he says, and renunciation of the fruits of action, that's even superior to meditation. Better than meditation is the renunciation of the fruits of action. Why? True peace comes immediately from that. As soon as you let go, as soon as you let go of expectation, as soon as you let go of having some stake in the action, you see, in what's going to come from the action, then you are free. Then you are actually free. Then you are living in a free way. No desire, no intention, no purpose, no individual will, and also, therefore, no stress, no anxiety, no striving, free. So karma yoga is the next yoga, and we'll do four classes on it, but this kind of gives you a taste of what he's talking about when he's talking about karma yoga, what karma yoga would look like. So that's all. That's all for wisdom. Like I said before, we started in the deep end of the pool. And you guys have been studying for many, many years, and good audience to have, I think, for sort of splashing around in water that's over our heads. And then we come back to something a little bit more tangible, a little bit more real, not necessarily easier, depending on your temperament. But the brilliance of this teaching in the Bhagavad Gita is that he's got a yoga for everybody. kind of depending on what you're attracted to. If you're attracted to study and meditation and trying to figure out, like, what's what, and, you know, all of that, then the yoga wisdom is your preferred choice, probably. If you're active, if you want to do something, if you want to keep busy all the time, if you have a lot of projects that you want to accomplish, well, maybe karma yoga is better for you. And if you want to just love, if you want to just let all of it else just go and just, like, love and open your heart and forget about the head and forget about, like, what there is to do and just kind of have that attitude towards your spiritual life. Well, then Bhakti Yoga is your man or woman. So it's brilliant. It's a brilliant way of dividing up the pie. It's got your mind, the yoga wisdom. Got your body, your activity, the yoga of karma. And it's got your heart, the yoga of devotion. Okay, I'll turn the sound back on and we can have a little chit-chat for a little while. So I think I can hear you now.
Hi.
Hi, Alicia.
I have three questions this time. Thank you for this wonderful, super helpful teaching. Definitely appreciate it. So one has to do with this idea of starting and stopping. When you take Nagarjuna's razor and slice up this idea of the beginning of the beginning and the middle of the beginning and the end of the beginning, I get it. But we acknowledge that certain things will stop, don't we? Like suffering. So how come we can't slice that the same way?
Starting and stopping exist only in a dreamlike fashion. It appears that things start, of course. It appears that there's a beginning to things, and it appears there's a middle, and it appears that there's an end. But trying to find those things, is impossible. So they exist, but like in a dreamlike fashion, so too does the cessation of suffering exist in a dreamlike fashion. There has never been a time when you weren't already enlightened. Okay? Your Buddha nature has always been there, just waiting for you to realize it. So it's never started. Your Buddha nature, your capability of being enlightened has never begun and will never end. And so the suffering that we seem to have is as illusory as everything else. It is empty. It has no real existence. It seems like we're suffering. And so it has a dreamlike a dreamlike reality. But when we wake up, when we are lucid about the dream, we will realize that no matter what has happened in the dream, it's all just been a dream. When we are lucid about the dream, you see? So there's never been suffering. Any more than, you know, being chased by monsters in a dream is real suffering. It's just a dream. It's just a dream. Just has a dreamlike reality. So I hope that's a... I know it's difficult and you know, it's hard to get our heads around it. But that's a fairly consistent teaching in both Hinduism and Buddhism. That dukkha, that suffering, has no real reality. If it had real reality, then how could we ever get out of it, you see? If we are suffering beings, then how could we ever be enlightened beings? You see, suffering beings, really. If we are really suffering beings, then how could we be anything other than suffering beings? See? So it's just an illusion. Suffering itself is just an illusion. It seems real, doesn't it? Seems very real. But so does everything else about the dream, you know? If it didn't seem real, it would be easy to wake up from in the dream, you see? If it didn't seem so real. You know, if it were like showing its like, you know, illusory kind of quality to us in a fairly manifest, obvious way, then we wouldn't be so taken in by it. So it does seem real. And it functions. It functions for us, just like a dream functions, you know? We yell and scream in a dream, we sweat, we, you know, kick our feet, you know, do all kinds of things in a dream. Kick off the covers, you know, get cold. But just a dream. Just a dream. Like a this is a very common expression, actually. You know, the more texts I study in the Sanskrit, the more I see it. It's like a dream. It's like an illusion, maya. And this means it's like a magic show. It's like a trick. It's like a magic trick. And you can't figure out like how they do it, you know. So we were talking about this yesterday a little bit, of trying to figure out everything, and you can't figure out how they do the rope trick, for example. You know, the average person who saw the rope trick, you know what the rope trick is? A magician will come, throw a rope up, and then climb up the rope and disappear. So old trick in India, you know. I never saw it personally, but you know, it's talked about all the time. And you go, well, how could that be? How could that happen? What are you talking about? They just throw a rope in the air and they how could you climb up a rope and then just disappear? Like, how could they do it? Well, no reason, no cause. Can't figure out the cause. See? It's like a rope trick. It's like an illusion. It's like a dream. It's like a mirage. You know, if you are in the desert, like in the cartoons and all like that, and you're, you know, thirsty and... you know, crawling along the sand, and you see a mirage, you know, it seems real. And you go for it. Oh, my God, you know, I'm going to get some water. And you believe in it. It's like a mirage. It's not really there. It's not really there in the way that we think it's there. So beginnings are not really there in the way that we think that there are beginnings. Ends are not really there in the way that we think of ends. They function, but they don't have any kind of, like, legitimate reality. They just have a dreamlike reality. If they had a legitimate reality, we could find the beginning of a beginning of a beginning of a beginning of a beginning. We could find some part in time, or in the same with ends. We could find some point in time that wasn't further divisible into its parts. And if physical reality had the kind of reality that we think it does, that we've invested in it, then we should be able to find the physical parts to things. We should be able to find a physical part that isn't divisible into further physical parts. And both of those enterprises are futile. Just as it's impossible to find a part in time that isn't further divisible into its beginning, middle, and end. It is impossible, even conceptually, let alone with microscopes and all like that, even conceptually impossible that there could be a part, that a partless part in the physical world. A partless part would be a part that didn't have a left side, a right side, a top side, and a bottom side. Okay? Because those are the parts. That's what makes a part a part, right? It has a left side, a right side, a top side, and a bottom side, front side, back side. That's what makes a part, physically, right? But every part can be further divided into its parts. A partless part wouldn't have right side, wouldn't be have a left side, wouldn't have a top side, wouldn't have a bottom side. In other words, it wouldn't be a part anymore. It would be unknowable. It would be everything. So no absolute building blocks of reality. No absolute findable building blocks of reality, either in time or space. It is empty. Things are empty. It has only a dreamlike quality, only a dreamlike reality, not a real reality, you see? And everywhere, every time we try to grasp to something that has a real reality, we end up grasping to fingers, especially, grasping to feathers, especially if we're using our buddhis here. So this is buddhi yoga right now that we're doing here, okay? Think. We just think. We have to think. You know, can there be beginnings? Can there be ends? Can there be parts that don't have further parts? Can things exist the way they seem to? And it is impossible. That's using our heads, okay? That's using concepts. We use concepts to realize that our concepts are impossible. And then we have a deeper and unmediated kind of sense of true reality when we have mystical experiences, when we confront reality as it is without concepts, without superimposing concepts on reality as it is. And that's a deeper level of wisdom. Yeah, the way that bhakti or devotion came into Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism arose as a kind of a Buddhist response to a pan-Indian devotional movement, and so this is the Buddhist expression. One of the main expressions of bhakti in Buddhism is the figure of the Bodhisattva, who is driven by compassion and is devoted, compassionately devoted in love and compassion to all other beings. And that's a very good model for devotion. So the Bodhisattva isn't like just devoted to people that he or she likes, or that people that he or she admires or something like that, you see? Universal love. And the other way that it crept into Buddhism is in Guru Yoga, and also into some of the other kinds of forms of Indian religion, and that's, I think, a little bit trickier, because Guru Yoga has been so misunderstood and so misused that I find nowadays that I'm just shy about teaching it, because I've seen in my own mind, in my own experience, and in students, how many different ways that can be misunderstood and go wrong. So I would say Guru Yoga at this point, just personally, it's my belief that Guru Yoga at this point in our time and culture is a very, very dangerous yoga. It's a very, very dangerous yoga to practice, because we don't get it. We screw it up in all kinds of ways, and on both ends, on the from the student point of view and from the guru point of view. So I'd leave it alone myself. If you wanted to be devoted to a guru, be devoted to your inner guru. Be devoted to the guru who is within, that then you manifest in all kinds of ways in the outer world. But just like these teachings in the Bhagavad Gita, in a way you could say that whole distinction between outer and inner is just false. There's nothing that's really outside of you that isn't inside of you, and vice versa. So You know, that's another kind of aspect of what we call interdependence in Buddhism. There's no subject without an object, and there's no object without a subject. Everything exists interdependently, and neither can come first. Okay? So in terms of the guru, you can say, well, there's no guru outside of me until and unless there's a guru inside of me. And there's no guru inside of me that I can recognize until and unless I start recognizing the guru outside of me. And neither one can come first. So they're both coming from the same place. But that place isn't you, you see? I mean, this is, I think, kind of critical to get, okay? You are not projecting your world. I mean, that's just a megalomaniac kind of version of attachment to self. To think that I say my name to myself and projecting my world. You know, the world is projecting you as much as you are projecting the world. There's no you without the world, and there's no world without you. And neither one can come first. Neither can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. So there's no outside guru unless there's an inside guru. There's no inside guru unless there's an outside guru. And neither one can come first. So back to what I was saying about the dangers of guru yoga due to the misuse and misunderstanding of that practice. It may be better at this point to concentrate on the guru within, and then to respect the guru within by respecting the manifestations of the guru within in the many different forms that the guru takes in your external world. Not just one. It's the idea that there... I'll put it like differently. The idea that there is a special individual person who is the guru in a kind of like supernatural divine way, you know, is a misunderstanding of guru yoga. The guru is not limited. The guru is not encased in any particular individual. The real understanding, the deeper understanding, the sophisticated understanding of guru yoga is that the guru is Krishna, is God, and that is your true self. And the guru manifests everywhere. And the teachings come not just in formal teachings, you know, that you have at the Mahasukha Center, not just in when the Dalai Lama shows up to Los Angeles, not just in, you know, in sort of those kinds of formats. The teachings of the Guru are occurring all the time. And if we listen, we will hear them. And that's a kind of a deeper and safer way of, and truer, deeper, truer, and safer way of practicing Guru Yoga, is to listen for the teachings that your Guru is giving in every encounter that you have in life, with every being. Okay?
I may have a quick question, and if it's not quick, we can do it another time. Saying frequently accepting reality as it is, which is reality as it is a manifestation of the world within the world of appearances. So there's, you know, like the work is to accept reality as it is, and then as well you're talking about getting in touch with the self that is not you saying your name to yourself, but the larger self, that space of ultimate reality, that space of non-conceptual thought, non-conceptual experience. And it's not that I'm seeing these two things as contradictions, like I'm not trying to say, well, you know, pick one or the other, I can only do one of them. But I think that there is a relationship between the two that I would love to hear you talk about.
Yeah, you know, there was a section there in today's class where the Gita tried to talk about it, and it wasn't as, I mean, maybe it's just me, but it didn't seem as clear as in other texts, the relationship between, you know, just that the reality, ultimate reality, the world of manifestation, the unmanifest one, and so forth. The clearest, one of the clearest versions of an explanation on that, I think you find in the Vijnana by Rivatantra, which is presented as a conversation between Shiva and Shakti. Shiva representing ultimate reality, Shakti representing the world of manifestation. And Shiva, you know, Shakti is like goddess. She's the goddess, and Shiva's God. So, but they pretend, especially Shakti pretends, like, well, I'm confused about, you know, where you are, Shiva, who you are. I'm confused about, you know, ultimate reality. And Shiva says, you are my very face. The very face of Shiva is Shakti. And so they aren't really different. They appear different, you know? They appear like they're two different. And then the text beautifully ends. The last verse of the text ends after this long, big teaching and like that. And then they embrace. Shiva and Shakti come back together, you know, as one. They appear as two things. So, you know, manifest reality and ultimate reality appear as two different things. And then we say, well, I'll just concentrate on one or the other. And it's kind of impossible to do that, first of all. You know, for example, if you're trying to do emptiness meditations without the appearance of something that is empty, you're just spacing out, or you're imagining like black holes or something. You know, it's just, you know, not really what is meant by emptiness. So there's nothing. The trick is to try to see the face of Shiva in Shakti. You know, to try to see ultimate reality in the world of appearances, not to see them as separate things. And so it's always a wonderful teaching, actually, on the acceptance. You know, again, on acceptance of the world of appearances. It's not that there has to be a different world of appearances. You know, better world of appearances, or world where appearances appear better, you see. Shiva's never not been there in Shakti, you know. Ultimate reality has never not been in the world of deceptive reality, and always will be. So we use one to get to the other. Yeah, that's another thing that that's said in the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra in a way that's, I think, maybe more understandable. You can't know the sun unless there's light, you know, unless there's sunlight. You can't see the sun. So the sunlight is Shakti, is the world of appearances. And it is through the sunlight that we can see the sun that's making the sunlight, or that it can't exist without the sunlight, actually. What would it mean to say that there's sun without sunlight, you know? So they are two aspects of the same thing. But one is, you know, changing and, you know, particularized and individualized and manifest in lots of diversity and so forth. And the other one is unified. But they are just two aspects of the same thing. Unity and diversity. Yeah. Emptiness is form, and form is emptiness. Heart Sutra, right? What the hell does that mean? Form is emptiness. And it doesn't say form is like emptiness, or there's an emptiness to form, or something like that. Form is emptiness. And emptiness is form. And that's another way of kind of talking about the exact same thing. You know, they are just two aspects of the same reality. How can there be two realities? There's no deceptive reality and ultimate reality. That's just a way of thinking. There's only one reality. What kind of science fiction novel would we be living in where there's two realities? You know? How can reality be multiple? Reality is one. And then you can see it in two different ways. One is in the world of manifestation, one is in the world of, you know, emptiness or unity or oneness or, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know. Calling it is part of the problem, you know, trying to name it, trying to capture it in some kind of conceptual framework is already losing it, you know. So you could put it like that too. There is the world of concept, there's the world of form, this world of ideas, and then there's the non-conceptual that cannot be talked about, cannot be put into form. But is indissolvable, inseparable from the world of form at the same time.